Turning to Psalm 39, you can't do it now, but at some point, fairly soon afterwards, would you also take on board Psalms 38 and 32? I say that now, and then you'll see the pattern. I said, I will take heed to my ways. When I was a paper boy, I used to go through gates, and many of them said, beware of the dog. And of course, some of the dogs we got to know, and if you put your finger through the letterbox, even a tiny bit with the paper, there was a snapping at fingertips. And this word, take heed, means beware. Take heed. Watch out, be careful, however you care to look at it. And David is saying here, but it's for the benefit of every believer ever since. He said in his heart, I will take heed to my ways. Now, for a Christian believer, that is a lifelong work of chastening by the Lord and of thinking within our hearts that we might take heed to how we act, take heed to how we respond to people, take heed to how we interact, take heed to all sorts of things. But there is one outstanding thing. I said, I will take heed to my ways that I sin not with my tongue. Now, we read in James that the tongue is unruly. That means it won't be ruled. We ought ourselves to be able to control our tongues, for our brains controls the things we do. But the tongue seems to have a mind of its own. And if it is that with the tongue you consider that it does reveal the things that are deeply part of your character, then that makes the wonder of the evil of the tongue seem more hard towards us. Sinning not with the tongue. Words can never be withdrawn. We pierce someone's heart with a word, and maybe they will forgive us, but they will not forget us. The hurt went too deep. We sin with our tongues in the sense that Jesus spoke of every idle word that man shall speak, shall he give answer thereof in the day of judgment. We speak idle words, we speak nonsense in terms of spiritual things so often. And that's coming up later. But we have to decide in our hearts that we're going to take heed to our ways, that we sin not with our tongue. We all have different gifts. We all have different failings. And for some, it may be harder than others. But the greater our frailty, the more the Lord's strength and help. Take heed that you sin not with your tongue. I will keep my mouth with a bridle while the wicked is before me. Now, we read in James that the bridle is put into the mouth of a horse, so even a large horse can be controlled, brought to turn the other way, brought to a stand, whatever it is. And it is possible, in one sense, to discipline the tongue, to reduce its horrible content without actually ever taming it. I was interested in the picture of taming that is in James. We tame all manner of brute beasts and we rein them in. But it's always another creature. We train the dog to go to the toilet in the right place. We train the cat to use the cat litter, whatever it is. But taming the tongue is not something that we do for somebody else. It's taming ourselves. And that is a harder thing to do. And particularly when unbelievers are present. If unbelievers hear the things we talk about, if unbelievers hear the criticism that we say, if unbelievers hear our doubts and our fears as we're going through them, when we ought to keep them to ourselves, we do incalculable damage. So we take heed with our tongue. Now, in verse 9, it says, I was dumb. Which is exactly what it says in verse 2. I was dumb with silence, that is, I was dumb and kept silent. But in verse 9, it tells you a little bit about what he was dumb about. I opened not my mouth because thou didst it. But remove thy stroke from me. I am consumed by the blow of thine hand. Now, we are not entitled to look at people and say, oh, this illness has happened to them. They must have been done something wrong. That's what Job's friends did. But we are entitled ourselves to say about ourselves, if we know it to be true, that this evil has befallen us because of something in which we need to be disciplined. And it was that in which David was dumb about. Now, do you remember when we looked at Psalm 32 at the weekend? We thought of the words that day and night thy hand was heavy upon me. When I kept silence, my bones waxed old through my roaring all the day long. Now, at that stage, David had been healed. His sins had been forgiven. He was rejoiced. He's talking about the past. When I kept silence about my sin, my bones waxed old through my roaring all the day long. For day and night thy hand was heavy upon me. My moisture is turned into the drought of summer. But I acknowledge my sin unto thee, and all that stopped. Now, Psalm 38, which I suggested you read at some later time, takes us through what was happening to him, the actual things that were going wrong with him. It says in Psalm 38, my wounds stink and are corrupt because of my foolishness. My loins are filled with a loathsome disease. There is no soundness in my flesh. I'm feeble and sore broken. I have roared by reason of the disquietness of my heart. So there we see the passage of the evil things that are happening to David because of something he's done. When it's all over, we see it explained in Psalm 32. And Psalm 39 comes between them. David has been suffering these terrible things. And he's saying to himself, I'm not going to tell all and sundry. I'm not going to tell all the things that I'm going through, all the things that are my fault, lest it ruins their faith. And I'm not going to tell unbelievers, lest they think that they can't become Christians if they go through these things, if I put a bad light upon them. So he says, I was dumb with silence. The things I didn't talk about, I bore them up in my own spirit. Now, later on, we'll be singing number 39 from the hymn book. But it has a lovely, lovely verse. Yet will I not hold back from prayer, but all my case to thee present. Here's the words. Lest inner griefs be stirred to fire from brooding long in discontent. If we dwell on the things that are bad in this world, even if we brought them upon ourselves, and we don't give vent to God, the fire will burn within us and it'll make us unlivable with ourselves even. The fire will burn the more we meditate about the evils that have happened to us or the things that are going on to the world. The only cure is to turn to the Lord. As long as we keep them to ourselves, we will burn with fire. But when we turn to the Lord, then the Lord hears and answers prayers, and that'll be the beginning of our healing. I was dumb with silence. I held my peace, even from good. So it wasn't good for me to hold my peace, but it was good for everybody else. We come across that, don't we? I ask people, and you ask people, how are you? Yeah, I'm fine, they say, and you know very well they're not. But they're fulfilling this, you see. They're not spoiling other people's lives by putting forth things that they're going through. They just say, I'm okay. It's a good thing to do. There are times for sharing. There are times when we've been through an experience and somebody else is going through it, and we do need to share it. But on the whole, we hold our peace. And though it's bad for us because it keeps being pent up inside us, it is good that others don't know these things. And he says, I held my peace, but my sorrow was stirred. It didn't go away from me. I still felt the same. I didn't put on an act exactly. I just kept silence. I just didn't talk about the things that were the most important things to my soul, because they would have dragged other people down. And then he says, my heart was hot within me, and while I was musing, the fire burned. So these things within the tongue that set the world on fire, not being spoken, might set you on fire. My heart was hot. I was heated about the whole matter, about how God was dealing with me, about how relatives were dealing with me, about the unfairnesses of life. I was growing hot, hot under the collar, we would say. And while I was thinking about these things, the fire burned. It didn't take much to make the fire which will destroy me burn within me. And it might spread, as we've seen wildfire fires spreading. I'd like to illustrate this in a slightly different way, if you care to turn to Job and to Job chapter 4. Now, Eliphaz here is relating to Job why how God has spoken to him. Now, we know from what Eliphaz says in his dealings with Job that God hadn't spoke to him. He was mistaken. And you can see why he was mistaken when you read these words. He says, this is how the word came to me. Chapter 4, verse 15 of Job. Then a spirit passed before my face. The hair of my flesh stood up. Is that how the Lord speaks to us? Of course it isn't. It's Satan. It stood still. but I could not discern the form thereof. An image was before mine eyes. There was silence, and I heard a voice saying, "Shall mortal man be more just than God?" And so on. Now, what I'm saying is here was a man whose spirit had been moved, and he was sure what he had to say was right, and it was a false spirit that had got hold of him. Now, this isn't exactly the same, but he's saying that while his heart was hot within him, something was beginning to happen that wasn't helpful. While I was musing, the fire burned in my heart. But instead of speaking to man, he did the better thing. He spoke to God. That fire that was burning him up, because he'd been so ill, so sick, because he knew he was so guilty, which may not be our condition, but nevertheless, the Lord chastens us. So he says, "I spoke with my tongue, but it was to the Lord." It was put into scripture. It was so much of the Lord, if you like. And verse 4, he says, "Lord, make me to know mine end and the measure of my days, what it is that I may know how frail I am." So going through this experience, he's saying to the Lord, "Where's all this leading? Is there any more for me to do in life? Have I got very long to do it? How should I be getting on to do it?" Now we know that David wrote a few more psalms after this one, and he had plenty to do. He's not asking that he knows on what day he's going to die. He's not asking that sort of thing. But he wants to know how he should measure his life in view of the things that were remaining to be done that God had chosen for him. So out of all this inward burning that was getting him nowhere, he turned to the Lord, "Make me to know mine end. Is there a way out of all this? Are you going to forgive me? Am I going to have further opportunity? How should I pace myself to measure my days and do a maximum amount of spiritual good with the life I have remaining? Will you spare me to do that? Lord, make me to know mine end and the measure of my days." Now, I ask that prayer myself, but not that I want an answer, you see. I don't know what the measure of my days is. I can't expect that they're very many or much. But I simply say these things to the Lord in order that I may serve my generation as the best I can with the days I have left. So make me to know mine end and the measure of my days. We can say these things when we're suffering and where there seems no way out, pleading with the Lord to make us yet useful and serviceable in the work of his kingdom. Make me to know mine end and the measure of my days, what it is, that I may know how frail I am. We know that David, when he was young, before he was anointed, was ruddy and handsome. Those days had perhaps gone, because he's much older now. But why does he want to know how frail he is? Partially, that he shouldn't brag. All the gifts that we have are given to us by the Lord, and therefore, if we can do anything well, like he could look after sheep, like he could transfer that to looking after a nation, then may the Lord do it in us. But I'm frail. David has sinned. He sins a number of times with quite major sins, not least counting the people. But he says, I want to know how frail I am. Now, the real reason for that is that, as the Lord said to Paul, my strength is made perfect in weakness. If I understand my real frailty, then I will cast myself the more upon the Lord. If I think I'm capable of doing things just because that's how I am, then I won't get the Lord's help, at least not to the extent. But if we know how frail we are, that we could accomplish nothing as we currently are, then the Lord's strength is made perfect in weakness, and he will help us. Behold, thou hast made my days as an handbreadth. We have to get our life into proportion with eternity, or with life after death if we're not a believer. Now, I think I've always found it helpful to think that each year as it comes round, springtime, harvest, winter, and so on, autumn, we see a complete cycle, and the things that grow in spring die shortly after summer and into autumn, certainly die in winter. And if we live to be 50, apart from our very young years, we've seen it 45 times. But why that is so important a lesson is that it only happens in our life cycle once. If we don't grasp that we're planted as a spring in spring, and we're growing to maturity in harvest, and that we begin to fade in autumn, and will die off in winter, if we don't grasp that as an overall picture of our lives, we shall go badly astray. Thou hast made my hands as a handbreadth. Now, a handbreadth was reckoned to be four fingers from the base of the four fingers stretched out. Now, it's not very much, is it? Thou hast made my days as a handbreadth. And of course, compared with eternity, that's exactly right. So, always to be thinking about eternity and how we may serve our generation as part of that eternity and leading on to eternity and glory is a major factor. Thou hast made my days as a handbreadth. I've got to use them. I've got to use them well. I've got to use them frequently. My days are a handbreadth. It's not much in the scheme of things, but it's a wonderful thing that he's given a man or a woman or a boy or a girl to do. The fact that it's a handbreadth is neither here nor there. It's simply an indication to us to get on with it, to do the work that he's called us to do. Mine age is as nothing before thee. Well, I'm glad that 91 is as nothing before. But you see the point, don't you? The Lord uses us at every age. He has work for his people of witnessing, sharing their spiritual experience, preaching, writing, doing whatever they do. And it can be done from the earliest ages to the latest ages. But mine age is as nothing before thee. I'm not great because I've got experience. I'm not great because I've lived a few years longer than anyone else. Mine age, in the mind of the one who created the world, in the eyes of the one who matters most and has eternity in his hand, mine age is as nothing. And it is good for us to know how frail we are. It is good for us to know. Because we, when we're in the world, we know we're nothing. We don't mean anything, do we? It's very many people in the world at large. Nobody much cares for us in that sense. But we do mean everything to the Lord. But our age is no drawback. And our age is as nothing. Little age or big age. He will bless at whatever age. Verily, every man at his best state is altogether vanity. It is from this verse that the expression has come to us, the best of man is man at, the best of men is man at best. It's derived from this verse, you see. Every man at his best state is altogether vanity. Now, that gets you into a perspective in your prime, with brains that are racing, with hand ability, with all these things. Yet all that we're able to do as men is natural things. All that we do is altogether vanity. Usually the word vanity in scripture applies to idols and idol making. But of course it can mean just pure insignificance, things that are insignificant. So man at his best state is insignificant. Oh, we still read about the great generals, and they accomplished great things in their day. But what does the world today think of Scipio? Is Napoleon not just a name to them? Yet thousands of lives were affected. The man set up to be to rule Europe, though he didn't make it. Man at his best is altogether vanity. And even when we're in our prime and at our best, we are in and of ourselves. Nothing. Now, Jesus takes up the next verse. Do you remember the parable he told to the man that this man had barns? And he says, I've got so much. What will, how shall I bestow my goods? And he said, I'll pull down my barns and build greater. And the Lord said, thou fool, this night shall thy soul be required of thee. And then Jesus quotes from the Psalm, doesn't he? And whose shall those things be? Whose shall those things be? Surely every man walketh in a vain show. Surely they are disquieted in vain. When you think how many hours you spent puzzling over your work, worrying about your work, fulfilling your things about your work, and then in the bringing up of a family, we get disquieted. There are so many things our minds go through. Surely every man walketh in a vain show. Surely they are disquieted in vain. He heapeth up riches and knoweth not who shall gather them. Well, if you don't leave a will, the person you don't want to have it will probably get it. But that's nothing to do with it, really. But you understand the point. We do not know who will gather the things that we bring to pass in this life. And the more we commit to the Lord and the more we depend on Him, the more we throw ourselves upon Him and don't rely on natural strength, the better we shall be. And then in this wonderful verse 7, he changes, you see. And now, Lord, what wait I for? My hope is in thee. I want to get on with my life. I want to carry on. I've been moping and mourning, and I've been a great sinner, and I deserve all these things. But I've looked to thee, and I feel now I want to get on. I've been restored. And now, Lord, what wait I for? My hope is in thee. Deliver me from all my transgressions. Well, that's, can read Psalm 32 again and see what it meant to David. Make me not the reproach of the foolish. They don't understand how I trust in the Lord. They see these things happen to me and they just mock us. There's no point in being a Christian, no point in being a believer, whatever. Things that are worse than what we go through happen. And because all things alike happen to all men and women, boys and girls. But deliver me from my transgressions. I was dumb. I opened not my mouth because thou didst it. But I'm ready to move on. Behold thy stroke. Remove thy stroke away from me. I'm consumed by the blow of thine hand. I don't expect many of you will remember what used to be allowed in classrooms. But when I was a boy, the masters would slap our faces frequently. And at some point, it became an issue in the government that boys with ear disease getting clipped around the ear was not always wise and safe. But here, if you like, is the picture. The blow of the Lord's hand knocks us sideways. Sometimes the master used to hit you one way and bang it back again. Knock you back on course, having been out of course. So he says, remove thy stroke away from me, for I am consumed by the blow of thine hand. If this persists, then I shall die. If this loathsome disease persists, it'll get worse and that'll be the end of me. And I can see that you punish me. You've hit me hard. But remove thy stroke from me. I am consumed by the blow of thine hand. And then he has this wonderful comment, which we ourselves probably often think about. When thou with rebukes dost correct man for iniquity, thou makest his beauty to consume away like a wrath, like a moth. We used to have mothballs when we were young. I always thought it was the moths that did the damage, but of course it's the larvae that they lay. But we had loads of mothballs in every drawer that we had, because things really would come out with holes if you left them. Didn't put mothballs in and put things away in the winter. They'd all come out in the spring, all full of holes that had been nibbled. So he's saying that beauty, a man's beauty, is consumed. He's not what he was made to be. He's not what people want to see. When thou dost with rebukes correct man for iniquity, thou makest his beauty to consume away like a moth. Have you got pictures of yourself when you were younger on the mantelpiece? How do you see yourself now? Well, it's wonderful to be a mature man, but it's not quite the handsomeness of youth, is it? So, as we go on and go through experiences and we age, but the Lord can increase these exponentially if we sin in a way that grieves him. So, when the Lord with rebukes corrects somebody for iniquity, thou makest his beauty to consume away like a moth. We are not entitled to say that of anybody to whom that's happening, but they, if they feel it to be so, may say it to the Lord. Surely every man is vanity. If we do not become believers, if we go on in our natural state, every one of us shall perish. And all the things we'd ever worked for and earned for have perished, as all the cathedrals and museums in the world will perish by fire, incidentally. Everything is not going to last. Not even the details of bringing up our children and of doing all the other things. What validates it is seeking that the Lord shall accomplish these things in us. Of course we bring up our children. Of course we do our work. But we throw ourselves upon the Lord, His strength being made perfect in our weakness, ending perhaps something of the dearth that's been in our lives for many years. So hear my prayer, he says, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Hold not thy peace at my tears. Otherwise, don't be hard-hearted when I feel like this. And then he comes up with this expression, for I am a stranger with thee and a sojourner, as all my fathers were. You will find both these words in Leviticus 25 and verse 23. But never mind that now. I am a stranger with thee and a sojourner. Abraham was a stranger, not to God, but a stranger with God, dwelling in a land that was not his own, being buried in a tomb that was on heathen property. He was going to inherit the land later. So these two words, they concern the same thing, but they just illustrate it somewhat differently. I am a stranger with thee. I'm an alien here in this world. I don't belong here. I'm going to another place. This world is not my home. I'm a stranger. Others see me as being strange because of what I believe and how I live. I'm a stranger with thee. It's thy doing. And a sojourner. A sojourner is a temporary dweller in a tent. So we're not to put down roots here. Of course, we put down roots to live our natural lives. But this is not where we're gunning for. This is not where we're going. We're looking forward to leaving this world and going to heaven. We've been strangers in it and we're sojourners in it. But it's not our place where we're going to live forever and ever and ever. There's a city in heaven, city built of God. That's where we're journeying to. And then his last verse is part of his prayer. Oh, spare me that I may recover strength before I go hence and be no more. Now, I've often told you this when I've read the psalm. It doesn't mean that he's going to go out of existence. When he uses the expression, before I go hence and be no more, he simply means I'll be no longer on earth. But because he was a believer, he would be in heaven. But before I go to heaven, he says, spare me that I may recover strength before I go to be with thee in glory. Still work to do. And in David's case, even the Psalms were an expression of the things that he'd learned of God. Maybe we can share with others in our own generation such things. It's a wonderful psalm, but we all suffered to some degree or another, and we all go through experiences we've never been through before. So I can thoroughly recommend understanding Psalm 38 as to the painful, awkward, unwelcome things that we go through. Psalm 39 as beginning to see the way out, and Psalm 32 to the glory of when our sins are forgiven and these things no longer weigh heavily upon us. Amen. So we turn again to the Tehillim book and to number